This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 238 was recorded a day early this week on Wednesday, September 23rd, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases, and by FarmTogether.com, bringing farmland, a new trillion-dollar investment opportunity, within reach of all accredited investors. We've got a Macro Voices doubleheader on tap for you this week, folks. First, Hante Investment CIO Alex Gurevich joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss treasury yields and whether the U.S. 10-year can move to negative nominal yields, whether a secular shift to inflation is afoot, whether the U.S. dollar has begun a secular decline, and Alex's model for predicting stock prices based on historical bond yields, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our postgame segment when Bianco Research founder Jim Bianco joins Patrick and me in the postgame segment when we'll take a deep dive into the election polls and compare these figures to betting markets. I'm going to be making some very bold predictions about civil unrest escalating after the election, so be sure to stay tuned for those as well.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump to the S&P 500. Some people were speculating that that Monday was going to be a low, and it didn't take long for us to be almost right back down to the week lows. Do you think we head lower from here? What's your take on all of this?
Well, Patrick, clearly what we saw this week was more selling. You know, the rally that people thought was coming to reverse this didn't happen. On the other hand, we're not crashing either. I really think that the election civil unrest story is going to be probably the most important thing to understand. The crazy part is I can't figure out whether it's good or bad. I mean, certainly it ought to be bad. But of course, it's always possible that expectations of more Fed stimulus will cause any dip to be bought and, another rally ensues. I want to definitely get into this more with Jim Bianco. But before we go on, I'm curious. I think you guys at Big Picture Trading were playing this with that straddle strategy. How's that playing out? What are you guys up to?
Eric, we remain short the market. We didn't cover on the bounce, and so we're still looking for a further breakdown in the market. I think at this stage, a trip down towards 3,000 is entirely possible and something that we're continuing to monitor here on a day-in, day-out basis in our webinars to kind of just get an idea of whether that momentum is in the market for that one more downdraft. Nonetheless, Eric, let's talk the U.S. dollar because we got a breakout. Is this for real?
Well, Patrick, I had been waiting for a daily close over 94 before saying that maybe we're actually seeing a change in direction as opposed to just a consolidation. Looks like we're getting that today. We're actually speaking a little bit before the close, but we're looking at 94 spot 35 on the December contract as we speak almost at the end of the session on Wednesday afternoon. Looks to me like we're going to get that close. Now, is this a real secular reversal or is it just a bounce here? I think that's still undecided. We'll see what comes, but I also think it's important to consider this in the context of what may be on the horizon in terms of escalating civil unrest and the election, bringing maybe some more downward pressure on the dollar. We'll save the discussion of that for Jim Bianco in the postgame segment.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil because we obviously had a pretty good bounce at the tail end of last week, a little bit of a rollover here. Do you think oil has one more trip down to the mid-30s or is it still a buy on dip here?
Well, Patrick, I'm really on the fence. As I said in last week's show, we had what technically was a breakout to the upside last week, but I said beware of a reversal because I think what caused that breakout was a lot of jawboning by OPEC, and you know maybe that's more propaganda than reality. Sure enough, we got a stumble, but it wasn't really a reversal of direction. We didn't see that breakout continue. We saw it retrace a bit, but you know we still only got back down to
the bottom of the short-term moving averages, and now we're consolidating again. Inventory helped to fuel a relief rally this week. We got a drawdown in crude oil in 1.6 million barrels. Now, that was after API, the private data service, had reported a build the day before. So a drawdown should be bullish to start with, but especially when it comes on expectations that were set the day before of possibly a build, and it turns out to be a draw, that supported the market. But, you know, even as much as that caused a bounce in price, it came back out before the close on Wednesday afternoon. Cushing, Oklahoma, building a de minimis 4,000 barrels. Gasoline and distillates both drawing down substantially. 4 million barrels on gasoline, 3.4 million barrels on distillates. U.S. production ticked down 200,000 barrels per day to 10.7 million barrels per day. That's exactly where we stood before the tropical storm hit the Gulf. So we haven't seen the big decline of production that Art Berman said to expect in Q4. But then again, it's not Q4 yet. It's going to be Q4 pretty soon. So we ought to get Art Berman back on the show pretty soon to talk about whether or not he is still forecasting a dramatic decline of U.S. production in the final quarter of the year. But it certainly hasn't materialized yet.
All right. Well, let's move on to gold because, you're getting the dip. Are you going to buy it?
Oh, I'll buy it. The question is how much of a dip and at what levels do you buy it? So until today, we were stuck in that descending triangle pattern. And we just today saw a decisive breakdown below that 1900 level that would have been the bottom of the triangle. The next target that I have is just over 1800, maybe 1812 or so is where I see the level. I might start buying a little bit above that around 1820 or so. There's a caveat, which is 1859. Is the 100-day moving average. Maybe I'll be proven wrong again, and you know we'll find that the bottom comes at the 100-day moving average, and we never get back down to that support level I'm looking for. I've got resting limit orders starting around 1825 or so to buy more. Now, if we want to go and look at this from the other perspective, which is how deep could the correction go, I think the deepest correction you could possibly expect or hope for would be back down to 1377, which was the top of the major breakout zone that we never really did come back and test as support. Frankly, at this point, I'll be surprised if we get back down to that level. If we did, I'd certainly be buying hand over fist there. But I'm going to start buying around 1825 and buy some more if we get down to 1800.
All right. Well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield, because you would think with this market volatility, dollar breakout, all of these things happening, that this would even have a pulse. But it looks like we're stuck in this sideways range for the yield. It's like dead like a corpse. Do you think we finally break out here?
Patrick, as our longtime listeners know, Treasury yields lately have been a subject where I just really haven't had a whole lot of conviction. So I'm going to answer your question and the next question, which is why do we bring Alex Gurevich in with one answer? What's the story on Treasury yields? It's the most important thing to understand. What's the answer? I don't understand it. What am I going to do about that? Get Alex Gurevich on. One of the best bond guys and just really visionary macro thinkers. Long-term picture, you know, big picture kind of guy. We've got some really, really smart people that come on the program, like Charlie McElligott. But, you know, Charlie is usually looking at what's happening this week or this month in the market. Alex is a really big picture kind of guy. And I think that to answer these questions about the 10-year yield, can it go negative? Are we facing a return to secular inflation, of course, which has a major impact on the bond market? And also, where is the U.S. dollar headed? We really have to understand all those things in a concerted, you know, logical framework of what's going on and where the macro economy is headed. I think Alex is a terrific guy, and it's been, I was surprised, almost a year since we've had him on the program. So I'm really looking forward to this one with Alex. Listeners, we know many of you agree with us that we're the best financial podcast on the internet because that's what iTunes and Apple Podcasts used to say about us. Unfortunately, we haven't been reminding you to do those ratings and reviews, which keep us in our number one slot, which we really feel like we deserve. And by the way, that's what helps us get the very best feature guests to come on the program. So your ratings and reviews really do help us to get better feature interviews for your future listening pleasure. Writing a five-star review for Macro Voices is simple. The instructions, step-by-step, are in your research roundup email. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Well, Eric's interview with Alex Gurevich is coming up next as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Hante Investments founder and fund manager, Alex Gurevich. Alex, I am really, really looking forward to this interview with you specifically, because as our regular listeners know, and I know you're a regular listener yourself, you know there's three macro questions that I, number one, am convinced you have to answer in order to understand where we are at this particular moment in markets, and number two, which I personally have no clue what the answer is, and that's why I rely on smarter people than myself, such as you. So let's just recap those. Our regular listeners already know these. The first is, okay, here we are at almost zero interest rates. We've been below 50 basis points. We're back up to wherever we are this week, 60, 75, whatever. We've been close enough to zero that if you believe there is a zero bound on the U.S. 10-year, then by definition, the 38-year bond bull market has to be ending. So is it ending, or is it true that negative rates are possible? And if so, how negative are they possible? Question number two, are we on the cusp of a secular shift from disinflation toward inflation? And if so, could it be as big as the inflation that began in the late 1960s? And particularly, if that is true, is that something that really starts to run away in 3 to 6 months or 3 to 6 years? How long does it take for that inflation shift to happen, if it's happening? And finally, number three, U.S. dollar. Are we looking at the beginning of a secular decline, as some people have predicted, or is this just noise that we've seen so far? Where do you want to start with those three big issues, Alex?
Okay, well, first, it is very good to be back. It's always a pleasure. And the questions you are asking of course, paramount and central to understanding at least U.S. markets, but as always, U.S. markets are central to understanding the whole world. So I would probably like to start with first two questions because they're very interlinked, and the third question regarding the dollar is definitely also connected with the first two, but let me first think through the interest rate market. One of the things that I believe really helps long-term profitability is looking at historical pattern. The power of historical pattern never ceases to surprise me. An example of that would be, just to step aside for a second, I even posted that tweet and it got a lot of reaction. I said, somehow the inverted yield curve in 2019 has predicted the COVID recession. We don't know how we did it, but somehow we did it, right? So when certain things happen, then certain things happen after them. And that is the pattern. They don't have to happen every time, that they skew the probabilities quite a bit. So when I'm looking at the pattern of U.S. interest rate behavior, what I've seen in the past is when there is a recession comes, we have shock, rates fall dramatically, usually in a steepening fashion. Then there is some kind of relief, liquidity, things get better. And then very quickly, market reprices actually into new wave of tightening, as if like, which and all actually quite irrationally reprices into tightening. That happened both in 09 and 01, 02, that after recession, markets started to think like, oh, rates are going to go up in a few months again. That actually never happens. And that's a great opportunity to bet against rates going up. in the near future. And then we have kind of a second wave. Then, well, we're not actually out of the woods. We're muddling through. Stock market starts a new grinding bear market and rates really go down. This would be my instinct to look for that, but we already have a lot of divergences from this pattern. First of all, the original rates rally was much more flattening than it is historically. Even to my surprise, the curve moved much more in parallel. And stock market kind of did not really act the way it usually acts. If people looked for a second wave of sell-off, maybe it is coming, but it definitely was not in a hurry to come with new highs being made. And everything just looks funky and different in this environment. And we could touch about what things are different, but it is still important to remember that massive sell-offs, massive sudden sell-offs in fixed income markets happen at that juncture. And that it doesn't answer your question whether we can go to negative rates, but this is just a word of warning that even if you do think that we're going to go to negative rates, there is a scope for sudden, very rapid sell-off in the U.S. fixed income market, which could be eventually will trigger accelerating convexity sell-off. I have not seen it yet, but it might happen. So that's the first caveat. The second caveat, obviously, we know that there is a lot of resistance to introducing negative interest rates in the United States. It may or may not happen in the future. Honestly, it is hard for me to say. But I am increasingly thinking that we might be able to muddle through without negative interest rates. And that links to your second question. Do we have to have a catastrophic rise in inflation? That is definitely something that is being discussed because sooner or later, if you make more of something, it loses value. If you make more dollars, cash dollars, sooner or later, cash loses value. So far, all of this loss of value was loss of value in terms of assets. That is, cash has been devalued relative to assets. It has not been actually devalued relative to services yet in any meaningful manner. But I think there is a scope for that in the environment of limited supply of services and a lot of fiscal and monetary impulse actually letting people spend money and some pent-up demand for services. Because even though you can make an argument that people cannot like have dinners out for all the dinners they missed over the last 6 months, but still, if you let people go out now, they will spend probably more than they would normally spend because they will be like, yeah, I want to catch up on my travel. I want to catch up on seeing my friends. I want to catch up on all my favorite venues. And all of a sudden, they feel those venues operating at 25% capacity. That does create some kind of supply logjam. So whether it is real inflation to be concerned is hyperinflation, but in terms of showing up in headline numbers, I think there is a lot of scope for high inflation showing up in high headline numbers. In this environment, will the Fed really need to lower rates? I don't think they need to go below zero if we're showing high inflation headlines. Staying here would be pretty easy. And in this way, I am totally in agreement with your recent guest, Juliette de Klerk, who I have a lot of respect for in terms of her intellectual framework, that real rates could go way, way down. We could very easily see 3% headline inflation, 3% headline inflation, and meanwhile, Fed staying very close to zero. This is not saying that I think that hyperinflation is unavoidable, but it is saying that headline inflation, at least, has very large scope to tick up. And in this environment, yes, we might have seen the end of the rapid bull market because if inflation goes back up, there is really no reason for Fed to become any easier. Furthermore, very surprisingly, kind of like it's a contrary way of thinking, but I think if inflation does go higher than we think and there is overheating going on that side, there might be some scope for interest rate hikes even before people think. And this goes back to my old thesis that I even put forward in my book, which was written 5-6 years ago. There is a negative predictive power to interest rate markets. Whenever interest rate markets predict hikes in the future, like not in the immediate future, because usually the policy predictions are correct for the first 3 or 6 months, but policy predictions out to 3 or 4 years, usually whatever the market predicts, kind of the opposite happens. When in the past, market predicted rapid returning to tightening environment, that never happened. Nowadays, the market predicts us staying at zero forever. Maybe we'll be surprised and the hiking environment will come sooner than we think. And the last caveat, again, to throw another wrench in this perfect machine. If you look actually at a 30-year bonds instead of 10-year bonds, the yield is still fairly high, 1.4% relative to global bonds. And there is quite a bit of price appreciation left if they do happen to go to zero. That's because of convexity. Or if they go negative, then, like, of course, all bets are off. They could still double in price. That makes the betting on interest rates in the U.S. somewhat complex. Even if you have a bias towards, my bias right now is towards high inflation, but also Fed staying put, which means that it's hard to make money in the long run by shorting bonds. It is risky to be long them. It is risky to be short them. And even the very simple carry trades, like buy 7-year sector and carry it because rates will not go up in the next 7 years, I don't think they're entirely safe. I don't know if it helps at all or not, because I just threw stones in every single direction.
Let's move on to the third big question, U.S. dollar. Are we looking at the beginning of a secular decline, as some people have predicted and opined, or is this just noise that we're seeing right now?
I think the dollar decline is quite reasonable and expected. And I would think that, again, looping to what I spoke before, given that if we go to this paradigm of very negative interest rates in U.S., if we continue going through very easy policies, I think that there is a lot of, and based on historical pattern, I think there is a scope for further dollar decline. I am a little bit reluctant yet to call the major secular bear market on dollar, but I think there is at least a cyclical bear market on dollar. I think we're in it, and I don't think we're done. That is, in my mind, it is very reasonable for euro, for example, to go to like 130, 135 level. It is not a high conviction for me, but if you put a gun to my head and ask me, euro, where is it going to be next, 135 or parity? I'll say 135. So I think it is very much aligned with everything that I see for dollar to continue its bear market. And one of the counter arguments to dollar bear market is a kind of cleanest dirty short argument, the argument that, well, other countries are also debasing their currencies. Yeah, that's true. But I also, again, I'm sorry I'm kind of parroting one of your recent podcasts, but I'm also agreeing with Juliet's view that it's much easier for U.S. to debase its currency than for other countries. There is more scope for debasement on one side. On the other side, there are still forces of current account which are working against the dollar right now. And there is also dollar benefited over the last few years a lot from capital account surplus, that is money flowing in U.S. Treasury bonds and U.S. stocks from overseas. And that has been a bit maybe overdone, and maybe with this slow reversing, it could be dollar negative as well. So I think there is definitely a scope for another 10%, 10-15% on dollar decline. And then there is a scope for a more pronounced and bigger bear market even. I do not yet see as dollar completely collapsing relative to other currencies, but I do see potential for strong rise in precious metals, which is also a form of being short dollar, because precious metals, this is something that I talked on the podcast a year ago, precious metals, I expressed, when you're long gold in dollars, you are by default short dollars when you're buying gold. So if you feel it like, well, other currencies might be debased as well, then precious metals complex is a good place to go to express continued short dollar view. And this is the way I'm leaning.
I want to pick up on that conversation that we had, boy, almost a year ago. You talked at that time about the connection between bonds and gold. And you talked specifically about the denominator issue of the dollar in understanding the gold price. Why don't we, for the benefit of any new listeners who didn't hear that interview last November, give us a quick recap of what the conversation is about, and then give us an update on your perspective and how it's changed since the last time we spoke to you.
Yes, well, last time the conversation started with a discussion that I heard from a lot of sources when people were puzzled by the fact why dollar was performing well relative to other currencies, and meanwhile, gold was performing well as well, because historically, it seemed to people that there is this negative correlation between gold and dollar. And what I pointed out, that there is no real meaningful negative correlation. It's what I call the tautological correlation. The correlation between gold and dollar just stems from the fact that gold is, as it trades, expressed in dollars. While if we gold was trading in euros, there would be no correlation between gold price and dollar. Well, I don't know. Maybe there would be, but I don't see it necessarily happening. So there is a difference one must draw between meaningful correlation and just tautological correlation, which doesn't give any new information. So you cannot just assume that because dollar is a well-performing currency, gold cannot be even a better-performing currency. So in this case, in 2019, dollar performed well. It was one of the better currencies, and gold performed even better, being an even better currency. So that's all that meant that both dollar and gold went up. And there is no rule or mathematical principle why both of those currencies could not be performing well. And this is definitely shifting this year when gold is still a better performing currency and dollar no longer is. So all the more reason. So while in 2019, it made sense to me while I was long gold, but in reality, dollar was taken out of that equation for me because I was long gold in terms of dollars, but I was long dollars in terms of other currencies. So what I was really long is like gold in terms of Swiss franc, Japanese yen, or any other, or Australian dollar, mostly currencies that I really wanted to be short. This year, I'm more inclined to actually be long gold and silver versus US dollars. So that is a shift of the discussion. I think there was an interesting thing that I said back then that I got quoted on, though it was maybe slightly misquoted. What I said during the interview, the way people quoted me, that I said, when you're listening to this interview, you should hit the pause button now and go just buy gold. Don't even listen to the end of the interview. You have to go buy gold. What I was really saying is that not that an investment advice that people should buy gold, but what I was saying is that if you espouse a certain view, and that was the view that was expressed by you, which was expressed by Grant Williams, I think, who you talked to at that time, that the long-term, about the long-term prospects of gold. What I was saying that if that is the view you have, you should just pause, click the pause button and go buy gold. Because the future and the path of gold was very uncertain. And even before COVID, we had a lot of shakeups and weird things happening, lots of ways. If you were not in the trade, you could have been stopped out of the trade or stopped in on the trade multiple times.
That call proved remarkably prescient, Alex. People who paused your interview and bought gold did incredibly well. Now, as we fast forward, that was November of last year. As we fast forward to this week, gold has been consolidating for the last couple of months almost, and just on an intraday basis today, temporarily, gold poked its head down below some technical support levels, although it's back above them as we're speaking now on Monday afternoon. Is it still that kind of, boy, just pause the interview, buy gold, don't think twice? Or has gold already moved up so much that maybe it is time to think twice before adding to a gold position in this current market environment?
I think this is definitely a good time to have a position that you want to have. Whether from a technical perspective you choose that this is the spot to add or not, that is not really my strong specialty level because I'm not very good at technicals. And very often when things go against me by a few percent, I actually choose not to add because I don't want to be in a position of it falling further and putting undue pressure on me. Like if my portfolio or position already under pressure, depending upon how much risk space I have, I might add on a pullback, or I might just try to sit it out and not put myself in a more difficult position. And I would also point out that when I say gold, it's kind of my euphemism for the whole precious metal complex. It includes silver, platinum, miners, mining stocks. And I mean, I think investors should do their own analysis and choose which of those assets they like best. But those are all assets that benefit from increased liquidity. I think that it is quite reasonable for it to consolidate, for this complex to consolidate. It has consolidated before in the previous markets, and the previous bull market took us much further in relative terms. And I see no reason why this bull market would not. Of course, there are many ways it may fail, but the probabilities, I think, are skewed still to this bull market continuing much further. And my bias is towards not only gold seeing new all-time highs, but silver seeing new all-time highs and eventually platinum seeing new all-time highs and related mining stocks seeing all-time highs. And all of them are very far away from those. So from that perspective, I'm just cautioning gold looks actually expensive relative to the rest of the precious metals complex. And it typically leads it in the bull market. So maybe it is time for gold to consolidate and some other things to pick up the torch.
Alex, you're mostly known as a bond guru. That's why I wanted to start with the questions about bonds, interest rates, and U.S. dollar and so forth. But in this environment, everybody's got their eye on the stock market. And as we're speaking on Monday afternoon, we're seeing a new wave of selling, causing some people to panic and say, okay, this is it. This is the big one. The big rally that we had off of the COVID lows that took us to new all-time highs. That was just a bear market rally on steroids that went to new all-time highs, but we're actually headed lower than the March low. And today's the big day where it all falls apart. I know that while equities are not usually your specialty, Alex, talking to some of your staff, they sent us a chart that I want to share with our listeners. Listeners, you'll find a download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the red button above Alex's picture. It says looking for the downloads. Can you talk to us about this chart, Alex, and how you see the situation for equities? And are people right to be thinking, okay, we're about to have a crash of the stock market?
I start with going back to what I already mentioned a couple of times in this interview, talking about historical pattern. And indeed, if you look at the regular historical pattern, it would be very likely that sometime about now or even earlier or a little later would start a new wave of bear market. And because that has happened several times in the past, I'm assigning a pretty high probability to that happening. There is nothing particularly about today as a day that looks to me that today should be a turnaround day. There have been a few, even in this recent pretty relentless bull market, there were a few pullbacks. But I can see how, looking at the charts and like momentum indicators, you could kind of see that stock market is beginning to lose momentum. And I'm appreciative of that. But in itself, it does not hugely worry me unless I take into account the general pattern of starting the second wave of bear market and top it off with election anxiety, possibility of uncertain election outcomes and all of those things, and just generally kind of bad seasonality, at least for the immediate future. You combine all of this and I can see some anxiety around it. What I think was unusual about this cycle and why equities acted in a way which befuddled many people by recovering so quickly and going up so far is the difference in liquidity. In a moment, I will explain how it ties up to the chart I'm talking about. If we go back to very fundamental question, why stocks go down in recessions at all? Why do stocks go down? Because every recession affects very hard some specific sectors. For example, global financial crisis meaningfully hit bank stocks, and some of them like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, never came back. Some of them like Citibank, got diluted beyond hope. In this recession, obviously various travel-related, hospitality-related stocks got hit really hard, and some of them might be not coming back ever, right? They declared bankruptcy, they have the equity wiped out or not wiped out for some reason. That's a separate conversation, but probably will be. However, when you look at stock market as a whole, for other companies, companies which survive down cycles shouldn't actually be valued any differently in recession than otherwise. If anything, low interest rates should offer them support for their long-term discount models, and the death of their competition makes the moats only deeper. But we never saw it before, but we see, at least not so immediately and strongly as we see it in the cycle, where the companies with moats started to actually perform extremely well right away. So why intellectually, if you have companies as a ongoing multi-decade concerns, we see people saying like this, look at whatever, how unreasonable it is that stocks are performing so well relative to blah, 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 what where the economy is, where the GDP is, where the employment is, but why that connection exists to begin with? My framework is that it exists because of liquidity. What happens in recessions that liquidity dries out and hence people have less money to buy stocks. I can't really go through all the mechanisms of that, but you can imagine it. Less money to buy stocks, they're always sellers, stocks go down. It has nothing to do with any kind of intellectual long-term projection for stock market. But that pattern became so pervasive that people starting to trade that pattern, that the recession stocks should go down. What happened in this recession, there was indeed a liquidity shock, very short, which really crested in March. But the policy response was so unprecedented that liquidity shock was reversed into positive liquidity shock. And all of a sudden, people started looking at stocks and saying like, well, whether rationally or irrationally, as a system kind of acting as one irrational, one kind of beast that just mechanically responds to impulses. But the cohort of investors decided that, well, looking through, COVID will be gone. This whole pandemic will be over, but there is this ocean of liquidity in the market and their discount rates are low and companies with good moats will just continue staying in business. So why not buying them at a higher price? And that's what started to happen. So that is the, to me, the explanation of why people were so befuddled by rising stock markets. And this is going back to our earlier conversation when I mentioned the fact how cash, we are having inflation already in the form of cash being devalued relative to other asset classes. And that is totally makes sense because a lot of cash is being printed. The supply of cash is increasing relative to other asset classes. So cash is an asset class, which is, by the way, not a risk-free asset class. It's just as risky as any other asset classes. The only cash is only risk-free as measured in cash. If you measured cash in Bitcoin, cash would be very risky. If you measured cash in gold, it would be very risky. If you measured cash in stocks, it would not only be risky, but continuously declining asset class, like an awful asset class to be in, right? If you reversed it and thought that stocks are your benchmarks and look how your cash is performing, right? And you look at several hundred years of performance, would you ever want to hold this asset? Probably not. Not even when it looks technically good. So that risky cash asset became an oversupply and it started to go down against every other asset. So people who try to short stocks and whatever name those stocks, even if they're short some stocks that they think are tremendously overvalued, they are shorting Tesla, for example, and think Tesla is overvalued or whatever else they hate, right? They're selling stocks of that company, but in what are they asking for it? They're not asking gold for it. They're not asking buildings for it. They're asking US dollars for it. They get US dollars. And by doing this, by definition, whenever you are shorting, selling a stock and asking for dollars, basically you are going to the Federal Reserve and asking them, please, can I have some of your dollars? Please, can you give me some of this asset that you can print out costlessly in as much quantity as you want? And what does the Federal Reserve do? They say, please have your dollars as much as you want to. Oh, you want to short some more? Here's some more dollars for you. Now, what do you think is going to happen to this asset class in this situation? When there is no resistance from the Fed from supplying dollars to all people who want to have dollars instead of assets, clearly sooner or later, dollar will decline on average with regards to most assets. So, in fact, what I did in my second quarter investor letter, I did this kind of experiment when I replaced the word cash dollars by the word beanie babies. And then I started to rewrite typical investment statements by using the word beanie babies instead of dollars. Because beanie babies is a classic example, right? They're almost costless. You can produce them as many as you want of them. They could be in vogue, but do they have to be in vogue forever? But if an asset manager is saying, you know what, I'm being really prudent right now. I'm keeping all my portfolio in beanie babies and waiting for things to stabilize. And when they stabilize, I'll have plenty of chances to sell my beanie babies and buy gold or stocks or real estate. Maybe I'll miss the absolute bottom, but I know I'll always be safe in beanie babies, right? So that sounds totally ridiculous, right? The same ridiculousness occurred with cash. And it happened twice in the history. It happened in March 2009 when people piled into cash and got nailed. And they piled into cash in 2020 and got nailed. And I would argue that being in cash at times like this could be even viewed as violation of fiduciary responsibility because you put all your money in incredibly risky asset that is currently being devalued. Now, from this philosophical speech, I want to go to the chart. The interesting thing about this chart that I posted is that I created it in 2014. By trying to understand how liquidity changes and interest rates affect stock market. And if you look at the chart, there are this blue line and orange line, and they go up to the shaded area. The reason why I separate the shaded area is that's how far I published the chart when I wrote my book. And what was happening after was, so the chart was fitted back then, and it was incredibly crudely fitted. It's just a point difference. I'll explain what it is in it, but before I'm explaining what the chart does, I'll just say that it was just the first very simple, crude, not calibrated analysis. And even that very crude analysis provided a very good fit, which continued for the next several years. So there is a blue line on this chart, is the momentum on interest rates. What it tells us, where in 10-year yield is now relative to where it was 2 years ago. So if the yield is higher, we go into negative area. If the yield is lower, we go into the positive area. So positive momentum on yields is when yields have fallen down. So then blue line goes above zero. On the right side of the chart is the scale for the blue line. On the left side is the scale for the orange line. And the orange, what orange line does, it's 2 years shifted forward. This is what will the stock market do 2 years from now? What will be the change in the S&P 500 2 years from this point? So again, we're looking at backwards what has happened to the yields, and we are trying to see what will happen 2 years forward. If you notice, orange line stops 2 years before today because we don't know from any point of time over the last 2 years, we don't know how the orange line will resolve. Now, the reason why I constructed this chart, I wanted to avoid the fallacy that a lot of people are falling into. I hear a lot of people saying things like, well, we look historically and actually lower yields do not imply higher stocks. If anything, the opposite. Or lower yields do not imply multiples expanding. Actually, historically, multiples contract during lower yields. This is an absolutely fallacious, and I will be very strong about this. These are fighting words. I think that it's a totally fallacious way of looking at the world. Because of course, lower yields typically occur historically at times of crisis when multiples contract, whether for a good reason or not, and stocks fall. This is not the questions we should be asking. We should be asking not where stocks are when yields are low, but where they will be after yields are low. That's the only interesting question for investors. Does it make sense?
Perfect sense. How do we extrapolate from this chart in order to make money in the markets?
Okay, so this is the chart. So the chart, the blue line tells us where we are, and the orange line tells us where we will be. Now, as you see, the chart starts in 1992, and this is the last time in the early 90s when the orange chart is meaningfully below the blue line. As you see, it's not that there is no perfect fit with those charts. That's not like perfect one correlation. But you see, orange line almost always stays above blue line. It's not perfect. You saw like in 08 when there was a very massive stock market sell-off, it managed to drop below the blue line. And also notice, this is very uncalibrated. What we're doing internally with real math is much more sophisticated and calibrated. But if you look at this very crude chart, you'll see that orange line is always above blue line. What does it tell us? It tells us that we have now 30 years of history that whenever yields have fallen, stocks typically don't go down in the next 2 years. If the yields have fallen over the last 2 years, stocks do not go down over the next 2 years. Not that they don't go down interim, but eventually they perform well. So the reason why I shaded the area in 2014, because that's when I discovered this chart. That's when I posted it. And let's think of what happened afterwards. We had a 2013-2014 time of taper tantrum. Interest rates have risen. What has followed? What followed was the period of stock volatility of 2015-2016. As you see, orange line, when you look 2015-2016, it spikes up, but then goes down, shows a little bit volatility, but well above the blue line. It did not allow it to fall below the blue line. So what happens afterwards? 2015-2016, and you see the spike in the blue line, right? Spike in the blue line 2015-2016. And this is what post-Brexit interest rates, and it's very confusing because you have to stagger things a little bit. The spike in the blue line of 2016 corresponds to the dip in the orange line in 2014 because, and I know like people would have to study it and think it through because what we see on the orange line is 2 years looking forward. What we see on the blue line is 2 years looking back. So in 2016, we had a big fall in interest rates. And what orange line shows us, the peak in orange line, is how well stock markets have performed afterwards. And you see that it corresponded to a big spike in performance in stock market, which was the bull market of 2016-2018. Now, when we look in 2018, we go back to 2018, forward, sorry, to 2018, you see blue line going below zero. And that was because we had a bear market for 2 years and rates have actually risen significantly. And see what happened in the next 2 years between 2018 and 2020, stock market had quite a dip, but not to cross the blue line. So now we're seeing the blue line going crazy up. Why? Because bonds yields have fallen down dramatically, which tells me that if this pattern persists, if orange line stays above yellow line, it means that S&P 500 2 years from now should be more than 750 points above where it is today or so, right? That's the rough conclusion. So if you believe in this chart and this pattern, it should make you very bullish on stocks.
Okay, so the outlook based on how you interpret the chart now is the S&P has about 750 points of upside from here over the next 2 years if this chart proves true.
Correct. But this is just one analysis, and each such analysis is just one little impact on your life. And this is when, and I'll be honest with you, I was getting a little more kind of bearish skeptic on stocks over the last few weeks. But then I started to rehash this chart, and I'm saying like, well, but how can stocks really go down? Because what really this chart shows, this change in yields could be really a proxy for the change in liquidity. You added liquidity, so assets are going to go up. And it seems to be as simple as that. And you take away liquidity, then you tighten, and assets go down. And what matters is not the absolute level of rates, but the change in rate. It seems that like a change in rates produces a lagging impact on risk assets. And like if you hike, and concurrently risk assets might still be going up. But at the end of the hiking cycle, when rates are now higher than they were before, that poses more risk for stock market underperforming. But notice, the underperformance is not a certain thing over the last 30 years. It's the outperformance that was always happened. That is, whenever we drop the rates, stocks almost invariably picked up. And with the only meaningful except, there were a couple of exceptions that they lagged a little bit in 01, 02, and 08, 09, when the drop was so high that it took them a little longer to get up. As you see, stocks actually do lag quite a bit below the blue line there. So maybe we could, so that would be like the scope for the error on this analysis, right? Those two situations. And both of them happened in the event of the double dip. So that is the error scope. But even within that scope of error, given how high the blue line, it is hard to imagine stocks being too negative from today forward if that analysis holds. And that is one incremental thing that makes me a little more constructive on risk assets going forward.
Let me just play devil's advocate on this, Alex, because what's coming to my mind is if this is all about liquidity, it seems like one argument you could make is, okay, well, if we see what the Fed's been doing lately and their reaction to the crises that we face and the possibility that we've got more crises ahead of us, boy, they're going to keep on providing more and more liquidity. That really fuels your argument that stocks ought to head much higher. I suppose the counter argument, though, would be that there's a growing political frustration with this notion that the bailouts are going to Wall Street, not to Main Street. And I think there's a big political component of the support for MMT where people are saying, look, we've got to do more central bank balance sheet expansion, but we got to stop pumping that money into the financial system, pumping up the stock market. We ought to be using it to help people on Main Street instead. So with those are maybe two opposite direction arguments for how liquidity could be affected by policy. Do you factor those kinds of things in, or how do you think about where we are in the current geopolitical and U.S. political environment and how that might affect some of your prognostications about liquidity in the market?
It's a good question, but I'm kind of sympathetic to the fairly commonly held view that Fed liquidity goes more directly to assets and less so to goods prices and wages, while fiscal impulse have more potential to go into actual consumer inflation. It would have to, I guess, after a certain point, fiscal impulse would have to go into consumer inflation one way or another. That's the commonly held belief, and I somewhat subscribe to it. So those shifts, but if we're having like consumer-driven inflation, I think it's also positive for stock prices, at least on nominal basis, at least nominally stocks are going to look good. And also being ability to raise prices is not necessarily a bad thing for stocks, even as wages go up. And asset prices inflation, if it's more on the size of the Fed, will probably be supportive in the other ways. And I think it's kind of like a water pressure system, water is going to pour one way or another. If, for example, we have some kind of gridlock in DC and there is not enough fiscal impulse, well, the Fed will have to do more. If there is more of an MMT view, then maybe Fed will have to do less and there'll be more spending. But either of those things will be probably supportive to certain trends continuing. That's what I feel like. I feel like even though I fear legitimately what the next few months can bring, I feel that if this next few months commotion will restrict the fiscal impulse, then the Fed will continue being aggressive, especially if we go in any kind of other down wave in terms of risk and economy, Fed will only do more. And on the flip side, they may not have to do so much if the fiscal side is coming through stronger. Either of those cases, I think, is in the long run constructive for at least nominal price of assets.
Alex, before we close, for the benefit of our institutional qualified purchasers who are eligible to invest in your fund, tell us a little bit more about what you do at Hante Advisors.
We run a macro fund. Our focus has been always long horizon, discretionary global macro. That is, we choose trades that are likely to work over the long horizon. It's a mostly discretionary fund with some systematic assist. People who want to find more information about how we work, there is a website, honteinv.com. So it's like the name of Honte, HONTEINV.com. And there is some public information available there, which is any interviews or any other piece of information which are available broadly, but also qualified purchasers can try to register on the website and get more. If you're interested in investing, you can get more information from us on what we do.
And for the benefit of our retail audience who is not eligible to participate as qualified purchasers, I think your book, although it was written several years ago, is probably just as relevant to today's environment as the day it was written. Tell us a little bit more about The Next Perfect Trade.
Yes, The Next Perfect Trade. It had a subtitle, The Magic Sword of Necessity. But yes, The Next Perfect Trade. In this book, I qualitatively describe the system of selecting trades that goes into my strategy. That as I describe the sequence of objective parameters, which makes a trade likely to make money over the long horizon. And this system became, in a much more rigorous and formalized way, is actually how I'm running the portfolio. It's a way of looking at trades and thinking what type of trades are likely to make money. And this is my forecast agnostic approach to constructing portfolio. And in this book, I don't give any investment recommendations. I just go through giving some maybe examples of trades from my past and my thoughts. I go through chapter by chapter, but various principles, which I think on a qualitative level make trades to be more profitable in the long run. And when all of those align, you get the perfect trade.
Well, Alex, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. We look forward to getting you back in less time than it's been since last time for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back right after this message from our sponsor. Farmland investing has been a popular macro trend among billionaires and big institutions for the last decade. But the high cost of buying an entire farm put this asset class out of reach to all but big institutions and the ultra-rich. FarmTogether.com allows any accredited investor to invest in fractional ownership of several different categories of farmland. I recently did a full-length interview with FarmTogether.com founder and CEO, Artem Milinchuk. We discussed the macro argument for farmland investing, performance and correlation comparisons to conventional asset classes, and the different types of farmland and their investment characteristics. If you're an accredited investor, I recommend that you listen to that interview and learn why farmland investing might be a fit for your portfolio. You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email, or just type the word farmland into the search box on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Check out farmtogether.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, that was a great interview with Alex. But joining us now in the post game is Jim Bianco from Bianco Research. How are you doing today, Jim?
I'm doing good. Thank you.
So, Jim, you put together a great chart book that listeners can find in the Research Roundup email, or if you're not yet registered, you can just go to the homepage of macrovoices.com and click the big red button that says looking for the downloads. Now, Jim, in this chart book, you start off by talking about the national polls and where things stand. So why don't you take us through what you're seeing here?
Yeah. In the handout on page two, I start off with probably the metric that everybody looks at the most, which is the least relevant of all, and that is the national average polling. This is the average from Real Clear Politics. And Joe Biden has a 6.5-point lead in the polls, down from a 10-point lead in late June. And it goes all the way back a year, and Biden has always led. Now, the reason I say that this is a useless statistic that everybody looks at is we don't vote on a national basis. We vote on 50 state elections. And we know that Biden is going to win California, in New York, in Massachusetts by plus 25 or 30. And that's how you can wind up with Trump losing the popular vote like he did in 2016 and winning the Electoral College. If you look at the polls, slide three, what's interesting is let's look at the poll analyzers, the Charlie Cooks of the Cook Report or Nate Silver 538, or even the Economist magazine has their Electoral College betting. Now, what they do is they analyze the polls. It's over. Biden has won the race. And, you know, 538's got a 23% chance that Trump is going to win. The Economist magazine has a 13% chance Trump is going to win. Charlie Cook says he can't figure out how Trump's going to get to 270 Electoral College votes. Slide four shows you, if you look at the polls, you're looking at Biden 353 Electoral College votes to Trump 185. So that's what the polls say. But if I go to slide five, let's look at the betting markets. Now, let me say a quick word about the betting markets. Let me give you a little history on the betting markets. Before George Gallup invented modern polling in the 1930s, we had betting markets in this country pretty much from the end of the Revolutionary War until the Great Depression. That if you were in the 19th century looking at your local hometown newspaper and there was an election coming up, they regularly quoted the betting markets that traded on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, which could be 30 or 40% of the volume of the New York Stock Exchange in the 19th century. So we've done this for a long, long time. The betting markets, let me talk about what they are real quick. They are nothing but an aggregation of all known information into one probability. They normally do not diverge from the polls. And I've got the detail in the modern betting records, betting markets since 1988 until now. Slide five shows Trump, I'll go from the incumbent point of view, has a 45% chance of winning the election, where the Economist magazine has, according to the polls, 13%. Nate Silver is 23%. Betting markets have it at 45. They've got it a lot closer. Now, what you're looking at slide five is predicted, which is the largest betting market in the United States. Slide six shows you the London bookies and a lot of the foreign markets. They have it 46%, exactly the same. Is this market manipulated? If you think every single betting market worldwide is being manipulated constantly for a year, then yeah, it's going to be manipulated. Now, the reason I say it that way is, no, they're typically not being manipulated. For what end would you manipulate it? Do you honestly believe that the election will turn because somebody looked at a betting market and said, oh, well, they've got Trump as winning, so I guess I'm going to change my vote? No, this is the way the bettors believe. They believe it's essentially a 50-50 race, even though the polls are telling us something different. Slide seven, there are betting markets on all 50 states, and the betting markets are showing that it's 248 Electoral College votes for Trump, 290 for Biden. And I'll mind you, if you're looking at this map on slide seven, everything here is from the incumbent point of view. Arizona's 38% Trump, Wisconsin's 35, Pennsylvania's 38. Those are not that far off. Trump is behind, but if he could pick off two of those three states, he wins the election. The reason I say it that way is Biden is in the lead, either way you look at it, the polls or the betting markets. But in the betting markets, it's a lot closer than the polls. Slide eight just shows you how the betting markets are shaping up in the 50 states. really, there's only about four or five states that matter: North Carolina, Florida, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, maybe Michigan. That's really it. In fact, between now and Election Day, I'd be surprised if any of the candidates did not went to another state other than those five. Because remember, that's all that matters is the Electoral College vote. And then on slide nine, the betting market, I just wanted to show you the orange line on slide nine shows you the 45% chance on predicted that Trump will win the election. The blue line says, will he win the popular vote? He's never been above 50%. He's only at 19%. Just like in 2016, when he lost the popular vote by 4%, there's no expectation he's going to win the popular vote. That's not how we keep score. We keep score via the Electoral College, and that's why he's got a 45% chance to go there. Finally, the last couple of charts I'll throw out here is on slide 10, which party will control the Senate. And I'll go again from the incumbent point of view because the Republicans are the incumbents. 47% chance they keep the Senate. That's a coin toss. So the Senate is a coin toss. The House on slide 11 is 85% Democrat. They're the incumbent there. They're looked for no change in the House. That's pretty much set to stay the way it's going to stay. Finally, the two charts on 12 and 13 I thought were rather interesting. Trump's approval rating on 12. This is over 50 polling sources aggregated together to show his approval rating. It has been rising. It has been rising since late July. It's at 42.9%. There's a couple ways you can look at it. It's well below 50, yes, but he's been below 50 every single day of his presidency, but it is in the upper end of his range. Interestingly about Trump, if you look at this chart, essentially about a 5-point range determines his approval rating for his presidency. There's a couple of outliers here and there, but basically most of it's been within a 5-point range. Now he's at the narrowest it's ever been. It's by far the narrowest it's ever been. Meaning, and I've heard some pollsters say this, probably 95%, if not 98% of the American public has already decided who they're going to vote for. And that this is really not an election about trying to convince somebody to vote for me, but about 60% of the American public actually votes. This is an election about saying, okay, you've made up your mind to vote for me. Now, how do I get you to fill out a ballot? That's really what this election is about. Please fill out the ballot in one way or another. That's why the mail-in ballot has become such a contentious issue as well, too. And then finally, on slide 13, there is a poll that they do called the generic ballot. They just ask people, are you more inclined for Congress to vote for the Democrat or the Republican? They don't ask a specific name. And the Democrats blue, the Republicans red. But the bottom chart shows the spread. It has been narrowing quite a bit in favor of the Republican. Now, the Democrats have always been ahead. They peaked with a 9-point advantage in mid-July. They now have a 6-point advantage, which is the lowest it's been in 7 months. So it has been narrowing towards that. And what I find that's interesting about this is when you ask, are you going to vote for Trump or are you going to vote for Biden? You know, you get that 6-7 point lead. But when you start looking at his approval rating and you look at the generic ballot, everything's trending either for Trump or it's trending towards the Republicans. The Democrats are still leading. So the bottom line is, if you watch the polls are telling you that this is over and Biden has won. And the polls are probably telling you, too, that we're going to have a blue wave and we're going to have the Democrats take the Senate. If you look at the betting markets, and the betting markets, again, I think are an aggregation of opinion, they've got it far, far closer than the polls do right now. Last word for you. The polls always ask the question, who would you vote for today? The bettors are looking at who do they think is going to win November 3rd, and they're factoring in the expectation that some unforeseen event, otherwise known as an October surprise, or something will come along that will change the equation. I think part of what we're seeing with the bettors is that they think that whatever comes along might be a pro-Trump event more than an anti-Trump event, which is why they're leaning a little closer towards a toss-up election this year.
Jim, please explain the concept of a red mirage. What does that phrase mean and why is it important?
So we've got mail-in ballots this year nationwide to a degree that we've never seen before. And the expectations are that mail-in ballots are going to skew Democrat. People that show up at the polling place on November 3rd are going to skew Republican. So election night, it has been postulated that you'll be watching the returns. Trump will have won all these states. He will have gone over 270 electoral college votes. He will give an acceptance speech. I win. Then comes the mail-in ballots. And one by one, as they count more and more Democrat votes, he loses this state, he loses this state, he loses this state, that by Thanksgiving, it flips and that maybe Biden has won. That's the so-called red mirage. Is there precedent for it? Well, sort of. In 2018, the last election, Martha McSally was she's a Republican, and she was running against Kyrsten Sinema, the Democrat, in Arizona for the Senate. Election night, Martha McSally was up by about 15,000 votes. Then they started counting the mail-in ballots because Arizona's had mail-in ballots. By Thanksgiving, Kyrsten Sinema was leading and became the winner of the race. Now, Martha McSally, you may know, is currently a senator because John McCain passed away and she was appointed to his seat, and she's running again for re-election. So bear in mind, the red mirage is that election night should skew Republican. And then when we start counting in the mail-in votes, that should skew Democrat. And we'll have to see if the Republicans have a big enough lead that the Democrats can't pull it back, or a small enough lead that the Democrats can pull it back. That's what we'll have to determine on election night.
Jim, I've been feeling a huge sense of deja vu going back to late January when you and I, one Saturday morning, I believe it was January 25th, had an email exchange. And you kind of said, Eric, look at these charts. Look at my projections of what I see from the exponential growth of the case counts in China, which at that time were still very, very small. We had dozens of cases, not hundreds, and certainly not thousands. And you and I both looked at those charts and scratched our heads and said, if this is real, you know, this is the beginning of literally something just huge, a global pandemic. And I think we were both sort of feeling like that's what the data tells us. But boy, to make that prediction publicly and be wrong about it, you better double check your data three or four times. And what I've been feeling really recently, Jim, is I feel that we have a very similar situation, although this one is not being driven by data. It's more being driven, I admit, by my own speculation and admittedly conjecture. And what I see here is a setup, and the red mirage you just described perfectly explains the reason that I'm so concerned, where if you look at what's likely to happen, I think it is more than 90% assured that most people in the country will become convinced that their candidate, the guy they voted for, is who won. And they'll feel that half of the country is trying to undermine the democratic process and steal the election in favor of their candidate. And the red mirage perfectly sets that up. First, the Republicans have the experience of winning on election night. It seems clear that Trump won. And of course, the Democrats are outraged by that. And then the mail-in ballots come in. The Democrats become convinced. No, in actuality, once you count the votes, Biden won. And the Republicans are saying, you guys are trying to steal the election after the fact. Everybody feels like their candidate won. The other guy didn't win, or the other guy who's being a sore loser is trying to steal the election. And you get a situation which by itself could escalate even without the encouragement from public officials. But I listen, Jim, to what's going on just over this past weekend. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez went on social media and told her followers, it is time to radicalize and get ready to fight. Okay, get ready to fight. If ever there were fighting words, those are fighting words. I think we have a setup for a dramatic increase in civil unrest and violence across the United States as a fight breaks out where everybody believes that their candidate won and they feel that half of the country is trying to undermine the democratic process and steal the election in favor of the other guy. Jim, I know this, and I've thought carefully about whether I wanted to say this on the air, but I'm going to go ahead and stick my leg out here. I think that the risk of this election mushrooming into an all-out civil war. No exaggeration, civil war. I think the possibility or the probability of that outcome is now higher than 10%. I'm going to say somewhere between 10 and 20%. So just to be super clear, folks, I'm not predicting that outcome. I didn't say it was certain to happen. I didn't say it was likely to happen. But frankly, when you consider how big of a deal a civil war would be if you understand the backdrop of the global geopolitical situation. China is just waiting for an opportunity for the U.S. to have a really bad moment that can be exploited. A civil war breaking out in the United States would have profound implications on the development of the history of the entire planet. And I didn't say it was going to happen, but I do think it's more than a 10% possibility at this point. Jim, am I crazy to think that? And where would you put the percentage possibility of literally a civil war developing as a result of this contested election getting out of control?
Well, let me define what I believe civil war means. And I think it does not necessarily mean that we're going to take up arms and Americans are going to start shooting Americans. But I do think that a civil war, if you want to define it as a loss of faith in institutions and a loss of faith in the country, to the point that there are states and maybe regions of the country that are looking to secede from the United States, openly talking about, I don't trust the government, I would put it at 10 or 20% at that point. For instance, you're right, the red mirage. If Trump looks like he's won on election day and then it gets pulled back with the mail-in ballot, and to your point, I agree with you 100%, whoever wins, half the country is going to be angry, is going to be not just disappointed or not just, oh, what's on TV? I guess that guy won. No, they're going to be angry that their candidate lost. And so you're going to have a big, big division right there. If it's won by the red mirage argument that I have, then it becomes even angrier that it looks like it was stolen. Even if the election is close, as I said, and everybody's been following the polls, and the other side, the Democrats will think it was stolen because the polls told us it was supposed to be a runaway election in the first place. So I agree with you that. And then what will come of that is look at some of the language we're getting, take up to arms. Let's pack the Supreme Court. Let's vote DC and Puerto Rico as states because we know that they'll skew Democrat and we could get more Democrat senators into the Senate. And then there was a guy from Texas I just read recently who's saying, fine, we'll break up Texas into every county in the state and we'll make them 80 states if you want. And I mean, he was trying to, you know, be ridiculous to prove a point. But this is how you have a loss of confidence in the government. And this is how you have people to stop listening to the government and you have people searching for alternatives to the federal government. If that's what we mean by civil war, yeah, I would put it at 10 to 20%. If we mean no, Americans are going to take up arms and start shooting other Americans, no, I don't think that that would be the case. It would really be about a loss of institutional belief, and in, I think that that's a real possibility as we go forward. Has this summer not shown us that we've got a lot of that already in this country to begin with?
What if we talked about not a matter of people shooting each other, but this escalating beyond just individuals? You know, it's not just Black Lives Matter versus, you know, Proud Boys versus Antifa. But let's suppose that the California legislature were to adopt a resolution to say the state of California rejects the federal government's, the election committee's decision that Donald Trump won the election. We do not accept that. The state of California is by action of state government, decrees that we reject that and that Joe Biden won the election. So that it's not just people getting upset, but it is states taking action to say, we reject the action of the federal government. We will not accept the president that, and it could go the other way. It could be that Biden has supposedly won, and it's Texas that is objecting. we get to the point where it's not individuals, it's not just people that are angry, but it is states taking action to try to usurp the authority of the federal government. It sounds like, I mean, I certainly think that's a likely outcome at this point. I would go much higher than 20% that you have at least some political grandstanding along those lines. Whether it gets to actual secession from the nation, that's another matter.
Got to be careful about grandstanding, because yeah, I could definitely see that states one way or the other could pass non-binding resolutions to express their displeasure and that they don't believe that, you know, Biden or Trump won either way. But then, you know, you start doing this enough and people then start demanding that you act on it. And if you start acting on it, if you don't believe Donald Trump won and you're California and you say that we're not going to recognize the election, then I guess California's left the United States. I don't know what else it means at that point, that then there's no more federal assistance on any way, shape, or form in California. Maybe California will have to put together a passport to allow them to you know, visit the rest of the 49 states. I know that sounds silly right now, but you can't make those kind of statements without the natural follow-up to that. If you don't believe X, Y, or Z is the duly elected official, then you're not part of the country anymore. And so, yeah, I could see that kind of bitterness coming out of this election. I could see that kind of anger coming out of this election and that kind of sharp rhetoric. Look, this past weekend, Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, and the Democrats are so upset that the Republicans might fill her seat before the election. They're talking about, we'll make D.C. and Puerto Rico states. We're going to add two more states so they can add four more Democrat senators. That's the only reason that they want to do it. We're going to pack the court to 13 if Biden wins, so he can just appoint four more people to overwhelm whatever happens and who gets to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now, maybe they think they're saying this just to, you know, satisfy the fringe elements on their side to give them some red meat to be excited about. Well, boy, you start saying this stuff too much, and people are going to actually expect you to do it. And if you don't do it, they're going to start voting people in that will do it. And then you're going to have a real problem on your hands holding the country together. So it's very dangerous talk.
I want to come back to the civil unrest. First of all, I agree with you that I would not predict that you have a sudden breakout of, okay, we're going to just take up arms and, you know, Democrats shoot Republicans on sight and Republicans shoot Democrats on sight. I don't see that. But what I do think is very possible is that after the election, there's a lot of disagreement as to who has won. You see, let's say in some Democrat-controlled cities, you see major protests that are more violent than what we've seen, more arson, more burning down of buildings, more looting, more of that sort of thing. And there is a certain amount of demands saying there has to be law and order, we have to get this under control. And Democrat politicians say, look, the reason that these people are rioting or protesting is because they're fighting for democracy, because the election that there is being contested was unfairly decided in favor of Trump. Trump responds by invoking the Insurrection Act, and we suddenly have, because the Democrat-controlled mayors and governors might refuse to take action against the protesters, President Trump takes matters into his own hands and brings the military in under the Insurrection Act. Now the other side accuses Trump of trying to use the military in a coup to steal the election from Biden, who, as far as they're concerned, won it fair and square. And you get an escalation of more and more violence, which I agree with you. I don't think it comes in the form of, let's try to kill all of the citizens on the other side, but let's burn down major cities because we're not getting our way. It seems pretty darn clear that people are ready to do that. They've talked very publicly on social media and discussed plans to burn cities down if they don't get their way, or even if Republicans try to replace Justice Ginsburg on the Supreme Court before the election. People have said they would start burning cities down just to protest that. So it seems to me that we have a setup where really it's not now until the election, but it's really from election to inauguration day, that it seems to me like just a setup for an explosion of increased domestic violence. Am I missing anything?
No. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that we learned about the violence this summer. Now, you know, there were protests and there were lots of peaceful protests, but there was violence. Most of the violence was directed at government institutions, police stations, courthouses, other government buildings and stuff like that, that they were expressing their displeasure at the government because the government is run by Donald Trump. Most of the, yes, and along the way, you know, regular businesses and homeowners got caught up in the process as well, too. But that's where I think you've got to bear in mind that, yeah, we're going to have, if we have those kind of protests and we have those kind of, and they break out in the violence, well, you know, where do the protests go? They usually go in front of the courthouses or city hall or those types of institutions to protest to begin with, if not the governor's mansion or some federal buildings as well. That is all about arguing against the legitimacy of the government. And that is what is going to be a big, big problem. So, yeah, I definitely can see that picking up either way. I do think, though, you know, let's not discount that on the other side of the equation, there are a lot of people that are just as passionate for Donald Trump as there are people that are just as passionate against Donald Trump or for Joe Biden. It's the people that are passionate for Donald Trump don't get as much press coverage, but they're there too. And so you could wind up seeing them lose faith in institutions as well. If we get into a case, the Red Mirage case, where they start pulling back on the mail-in ballots, and we start getting lawsuits, and we start getting federal judges involved with this, and we start getting kind of Florida 2000 100 times worse, or 50 times worse. We have each one of the 50 states has its own Florida 2000 kind of hanging chad type of thing. Again, you could wind up so sullying the whole process that nobody believes anything, and that even people that voted for the winner think it was illegitimate, but my guy won, so it's okay, I guess, because I got what I wanted in the long run. Very dangerous type of thing, and I think that is going to be a real problem as we move forward from here. And I hope that we wind up having what is considered to be a clean election. We wind up having a peaceful transfer of power, and we don't wind up with all this acrimony that we are fearing. But I would agree with you, 10 to 20% possibility is a real possibility that we could see something like this. Again, it's well less than 50, but in my lifetime, in your lifetime, Eric, I never even thought I'd ever see it above 2, you know, at that point in the United States. But now it's something you have to really start to consider.
I was alive, although just a very small child, in the late 1960s, and I don't think the risk then was anywhere close to as high as it is now. Let's quickly, we're running out of time, Jim, but very quickly, before we wrap the show up for this week, how do we translate this to an outlook for markets? Because you could say, okay, well, boy, civil war, I mean, it's got to be a market crash, but by the same token, you can say, guaranteed, the Fed is going to turn up the pace of stimulus. It could potentially, you know, support a market melt-up. How do you translate this into a market risk outlook?
You know, there's two things I think that are really weighing on the markets right now. One is this election that we've discussed, and the other one is there is a serious surge of cases coming out of Europe right now. Not the United States, but out of Europe. And there's a fear that there might be another set of lockdowns in Europe, and maybe U.S. is going to follow Europe in the next month or two in terms of a surge of cases. Both of those instances would lead you to be very, very bearish. But you hit the nail on the head. You've got something here in that you've got the Federal Reserve and you have the federal government, you know, basically passing bailouts for the airline industry and the cruise ship industry, and we're not willing to go down without a fight. So I think what you should be looking at is heightened volatility and you maybe a 10 to 15% correction, which we've already had. And I think as we get close to 15%, you're going to or should expect some kind of a reaction out of the Fed or out of the federal government to try and support the market. Or as I've been referring to it as, they'll throw a kitchen sink at it like they did in March. Then they just kept throwing one kitchen sink after another until they eventually got a bottom in the market. So they're going to fight this. And so heightened volatility. Let me give you a fun statistic. September 2nd was the all-time high. And on that day, the VIX closed at 26.57. That is the highest VIX level in history on the day of an all-time high. Usually the VIX moves inverse to prices. So when you're at all-time highs is when the VIX should be very low. It was moving up and at very high levels in late September, signifying that even market participants through the options market were expecting a lot of volatility. So yeah, I could see us doing a 15% correction. I could see the Fed stepping in, and I could see these kind of 2, 3% days that we're starting to see again, reminding everybody of the spring, sticking around for a while as we sort this out.
Well, Jim, thank you for joining us and giving us this great update. Look forward to having you back on the show.
Thank you.
We're going to leave it there for this week's show, folks. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by FarmTogether.com, making farmland investing a $1 trillion asset class available to all accredited investors, and by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplugged.com/macroguide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the link to Alex Gurevich's slide deck, as well as the chart book we just discussed in the post game with Jim Bianco. There's also a link to an article on the ECB calling on Brussels to make the recovery fund permanent, and a link to an interview with Brent Kachoba about weaponized gamma. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.